anybody out there?
Roll up! Roll up! Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, books, comics, sci-fi, TV, and film, live from the Palace of Glittering Delights!
And here, your host, Dandrew Leyland.
John Constantine made his first speaking appearance in Saga of the Swamp Thing issue 37 in 1985. He received his own series, The Hellblazer, in 1988, which was first published by DC Comics before moving to Vertigo at that imprint's launch in 1993. Hellblazer was Vertigo's longest-running title when it ended in 2013, and Constantine earned the rare distinction of being a mainstream comics character that aged in something approximating real time. John was different from the usual sorcerers and magicians seen in comics. Not for him were the flashy costumes, speaking backwards or outlandish conjuring tricks. John was more subtle than that. He didn't just dabble in the dark arts, he lived in them. And he didn't always know what he was doing. In Constantine, Alan Moore also created a quintessentially British character. Not a British character as seen through the eyes of an American, but someone whose culture, life and speech patterns were not stereotyped colloquialisms or out-of-date jargon, but with authentic rhythms and tonality. The locations felt real. Newcastle and Liverpool felt like Newcastle and Liverpool, not a foreigner's interpretation of same. With the kind of realistic feeling one only gets from authenticity. If you grew up in the UK in the 80s, you knew someone who smoked silk coat. It's why representation is important, people. Here's a guy I recognised from a place I recognised. British characters in American comics were often so badly written as to be laughable. These, amongst other reasons, were why the movie version of Constantine failed. It's simply not John Constantine. It's a perfect example of taking an IP and then using nothing but the names. It's also why the TV show didn't really strike me when I watched the first episode, back when it debuted in 2014. However, when listener Andrew Morton requested an episode about Constantine for his girlfriend, well, who was I to get in the way of true love? I will be looking at a number of episodes of the show. The first, pilot episode again, to give it a decent shake. Episode 2, The Darkness Beneath, and episode 4, A Feast of Friends. Episode 2, probably because it's a second pilot, reformatting the show and ironing out the wrinkles of the first episode, and episode 4 because it's generally considered to be the strongest episode in the run. The first episode of Constantine Non-Est Asylum was written by Daniel Sorone and David S. Goyer and directed by Neil Marshall. John is in an insane asylum in the north of England, although his card has an Atlanta, Georgia area code phone number on it, an immediate head scratcher. He's here after having sent a 9-year-old girl to hell after a conjuring in Newcastle went tits up, a development taken straight from the comics in form, if not substance. It's not long before Constantine is back in trouble, sorting out demonic possessions and ditching Genericsville, England for the sunnier climes of Atlanta, the area code thing apparently not being a goof, but a clue. Despite the change in locale, all of the references to Ravenscar Asylum and the backstory is directly ripped from the comics, as is the death of a 9-year-old girl named Astra, sacrificed due to John's ineptness to the demon Nergal. Astra's death has been tormenting John's soul, and I wonder if the series will go with the comic story that John's screw-up was what led to Astra, Astrid in the comics, I think, ending up in hell in the first place. In Atlanta, he meets Liv Aberdeen, played by Lucy Griffiths. Griffiths, who was Marion in the mid-2000s BBC retelling of Robin Hood, was supposed to be a series regular, but plans changed and she was dropped after the initial episode. Liv can see dead people, and with Haley Joel Osment nowhere to be seen, John takes her under his metaphorical wing, trying to help her come to terms with this new ability. You can see the series appeal of a character like Liv, who would presumably see dead people and then every week John would suit up and head to the next trouble hotspot to weave his magic mojo. It's a very American serialized storytelling notion, the instigating incident in every episode that wasn't present in the comics and isn't really in John's character. He's not a white hat who rides to the rescue every week. He kind of blundered into trouble, or more accurately, trouble blundered into him. Someone with literal wings is Harold Perrineau's Manny, who pops up to tell John he may not be damned to hell for the events of Newcastle. Manny has no direct correlation to any character in the comics, but Hellblazer dealt a lot with faith, salvation and redemption, but largely through inner monologue and turmoil, neither of which play well on TV. So the producers invented Manny so John can still have those moments, but, you know, in actual dialogue. Essentially, Manny functions in the same role as the angels on Supernatural, where they are portrayed, as they are in the Bible, as not always being altruistic and a little bit self-serving. Remember, in the Bible, angels are God's warriors, not benevolent do-gooders like Michael Landon. Also assisting Constantine are taxi driver Chaz Chandler, Charles Halford, and Richie Simpson, played by Justified's Jeremy Davis. In the comics, Chaz is a London cabbie, and he's had his nationality changed for the show, a sacrilegious alteration that cockney washes the cheerful, chirpy, salt-of-the-earth governors out of the show. It's political correctness gone mad, I tell you! Richie was a friend of John's from way back, and had also had his nationality whitewashed by American TV producers who were unaware that there are other places in the world. Constantine learns that Aberdeen is being stalked by the demon Furcifer. Constantine blackmails Richie into helping him, and together they trap Furcifer and send him straight back to hell. Aberdeen's abilities to see trapped souls would presumably have led to the series, where Aberdeen told John of this week's supernatural enemy of the week. However, Aberdeen is written out at the end of the episode, rather unceremonially and unconvincingly. It reeked of actor unavailability, or more appropriately, actor fired. And when I looked into it, it seems that Aberdeen was planned to be a series regular, but dropped after the filming of the pilot, which resulted in some refilming and re-editing. I don't know the thinking behind it. Lucy Griffiths is fine in an undemanding and thankless role, and maybe she would have lightened up as the series went on. Whatever the reason, Griffith's career doesn't seem to have been affected, as she swapped one DC Comics series for another, showing up next in the adaptation of Preacher. With Aberdeen out of the picture, she leaves Constantine the pendant and a map that will reveal certain hotspots for demonic activity. He accepts an offer to work for Manny in exchange for his redemption, which all sounds very much like Joss Whedon's Angel. The final scene, a reshoot, not present in the original cut, is a vague tease for the future, where we see a female artist draw comic books featuring Constantine.
Find out what's hunting the girl?
A demon from the inner circle.
Really? You know, a thing like that can't make its way here without serious help.
You know, it feels to me like you want me to find out some information for you.
I do.
Why?
If you figure out what we're up against, I will use that knowledge to save lives.
And what about my life, eh? You and yours damned me to hell. So, why should I risk my last days on Earth?
Why, indeed. You're a sideshow attraction. A peddler of shabby magic.
Hang on a minute.
Your decisions
sunshine.
Are questionable at best and without conscience. Why should you risk what time you have left? Because you are damned to hell.
At least for the moment, anyway.
Are you suggesting that it's not too late for me to save my soul?
The problem with this first episode is it essentially loses what makes John Constantine unique. He's saddled with an American sidekick, a peculiar accent, and dumped in the middle of a completely unsuitable location, Atlanta, Georgia. Matt Ryan looks the part, but has a weird sort of Irish accent which comes through on occasion, an odd thing given Ryan is Welsh. It makes the audience, well, me, wonder exactly where this John is from. He's clearly not a Scouser. In the comic, John was from Liverpool, but he's not Cockney either, but a peculiar blend of Northern and Irish. I can never understand saddling actors with accents where it isn't necessary. Given the producers had no problem at all in altering the other characters' backgrounds and nationality, I'd have accepted an Irish or even a Welsh Constantine quite easily. The location, I presume, was picked because Atlanta, Georgia has its own Pinewood Studios and has become a central spoke in the Hollywood filming wheel. But it's completely unsuitable for Constantine. He's a character that needs urban sprawl, back alleys and the scuzzy parts of town. He should be Newcastle or Liverpool or London. Hell, at a stretch, I'd even accept New York. Sunny part of America does not fit him like a glove. It doesn't help that Supernatural has been doing this kind of stuff, even going so far as to have an ersatz Constantine in the form of Castiel for 15 seasons at this point. And despite being the progenitor, Constantine feels a tad out of step. It's squeezing a character into a mould that fits the formulaic nature of US network TV, rather than adapting what made the comics great. It's well made, well acted, well put together. It's just lacking something.
My name is John Constantine. I'm the one who steps from the shadows, all trench coat and arrogance. I'll drive your demons away, kick them in the bollocks and spit on them when they're down, leaving only a nod and a wink and a wisecrack. I'll walk my path alone, because let's be honest, who'd be crazy enough to walk it with me?
All that being said, this is what we got. I can bitch and moan about the lack of fidelity to the comics, but compared to the movie, this is pretty much torn from the comics' pages. So, does Constantine work as a series in its own right? Let's watch a couple more episodes and see. The Darkness Beneath was written by Rodney S. O'Bannon, creator of Farscape, Alien Nation and others, and directed by Steve Schill. In this episode, John heads to Pennsylvania, where he meets Zed, the young lady seen drawing John in the last episode, played by Angelica Saleha. Other than Zed's introduction, The Darkness Beneath is a standard TV horror flick in which John is in Pennsylvania to investigate a series of violent accidents happening to miners in the town. Miners as in those people who go in tunnels and dig, not little kids. It turns out that the accidents are being caused by the Kolmenau, spirits of dead miners, who would normally protect the mine, but are being driven to violence by some mysterious conjurer. John discovers that the culprit is the wronged wife of one of the dead miners, who is using black magic to seek revenge. The bad guy was telegraphed in the teaser to this episode, so it relies largely on Skurr's imagery and the audience's interest in the characters to build its momentum. But it also exists to reformat the series slightly, thanks to the decision to lose Aberdeen and replace it with Zed. For the most part, this works, as Zed and John's interactions are the best part of this show, because the story is pretty routine TV horror shtick of a kind Carl Kolchak would have dealt with on his off hours. For one, the characters in the mining town seem awfully clichéd, even to a non-native. And for another, as mentioned, the red herring in the middle of the show seems to exist just to pad out the 44-minute running time, given that, as mentioned, the real bad guy was telegraphed in the teaser. Most of the episode is given up to setting up John and Zed, to the point where Chaz makes only a contractually obligated appearance, and Manny and Richie are nowhere to be seen. Fortunately, they work well together, better than Brian did with Griffiths anyway, and presumably Zed will be a permanent fixture from now on. Hopefully, though, the stories will be less routine than this one. A Feast of Friends was written by Cameron Welsh and directed by John F. Showalter. Gary Lester, another, if not deep cut, then at least a minor Nick from the comics and played by John Joe O'Neill, pops by to unleash a hunger demon in Atlanta. He's an old friend of John's. A safe friend, from John's Newcastle days when Gary was responsible for the whole situation. See, whilst high on heroin, Gary drew the demon Nemoth from a boy in Sudan, killing the boy and trapping it in the bottle. Yes, it's a genie in a bottle. Well, a demon, anyway. The demon takes the form of a swarm of beetles, takes over a person's body, and forces him or her to eat madly and incessantly. The person then dies and the demon moves on to someone else. Nemoth is let loose by airport security, who quite rightly spot Gary as the strung-out smackhead he is. It's up to Constantine to bring it all to an end. For the first time, this show is as genuinely disturbing as the comics, and the reason for this is apparent. This is a comics story. Liberally adapted from Hellblazer 1 and 2 by writer Jamie Delano and artist John Ridgway, the episode features some fine examples of dark humour, body horror, and a good look at John the Bastard. So far, the series has shied away from the aspects of John's personality that wouldn't go down over well with the audience of traditional network telly, and this has been a neutered John. Still John, but lacking some grit. A Feast of Friends not only has oodles of grit, but also gobfuls of moral ambiguity. For once, there felt like there was some substance to the show. The episode isn't about the bugs and the creepy monsters, it's about addiction and friendship and betrayal, and Matt Ryan really comes into his own, excelling as the charming but dangerous John Constantine we know and love. It's long been said that John's friends don't tend to stick around for long, and here, for the first time, we see why. John's cruelty and willingness to deal with problems with finality, no matter the cost, was a key part of the comics, and it's nice to see that characteristic show its head in the series, because without it, John is a Cockney Doctor Strange. The ending, while it's not quite as gruesome as the comic, still demonstrates that John is not always a good guy. This was a great episode, but it also demonstrated the problems with the show. John doesn't need sidekicks. Chaz is missing again, Zed is there just to bounce exposition off, and Manny's irritating. I know the nature of TV these days is to lean towards the ensemble, but I kind of wish this was more like the old days, with one lead actor who carried the show. James Garner didn't need an ensemble. Matt Ryan's take on John Constantine proved to be wildly popular, despite the show crashing in the ratings and being cancelled after 13 episodes. The main problem, as I see it, was that the show was simply on the wrong network, and I think the brain trust at Warner's recognised this, and Matt Ryan was brought back to appear in episodes of Arrow and then in animation, before being granted series regular status on the craziest of the CW's Arrowverse shows, Legends of Tomorrow. Constantine works well in Legends, where his sardonic nature can play against the rest of the cast's earnestness. It also helps that Legends doesn't take itself too seriously. So finally, it seems that Constantine has met an actor capable of filling his shoes. Admirably and ably, Matt Ryan has become John Constantine, embodying the part for a generation of viewers who may never even have seen the comics. It's nice when an actor does that, embraces the role that they're born to play, and I hope he continues on Legends for some time to come.
Fade Out, hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, let's delve into the bulging sack. Well, I say bulging, it's got one or two emails in it. Our first email tonight is from David Gutierrez. Hello, Dave. How are you? Dear Andrew, Andy ranks the Spider-Man. I agree with your list. How did this happen? Well, it happened, David, because you're a man of exquisite taste. That's what. As am I. So, you know. Have you rated the films of your precious Batman? I know Lego Batman is the best one, but what about after those? Ooh. I think that's something I should throw over to Bailey, actually. I think me and Mike should do that. Rank the Batman movies. That may be fun. And I think, you know, Mask of the Phantasm would be number one, right? Maybe you should just do a ranking of the animated Batman movies. Because there's been so many of them, but then I've not seen them all. So this idea just gets more and more complicated. So would you just do theatrical Batman movies then? In which case, Revenge of the Joker wouldn't count. And I actually think that's the second best one after Mask of the Phantasm. So I'm kind of... Yes, it's problematic, that, doing the Batman ones. Oh, I'll think of something, I'm sure. Another Dave emailed in. Dave McKelvin here. Hello, David. Hello, Andrew. It's Dave week here at the Palace of Glitter and Delights. Greetings, Andrew. Greetings, Dave. I enjoyed your rankings of the Spider-Man movies, and I think I agree with your order. Before I listened to this episode, I had not watched Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, probably because I've always associated the idea of a multiverse mainly with DC, and I haven't read any Spider-Man comics for ages, so I had no familiarity with Miles Morales. I think not having a familiarity with Miles Morales wouldn't hinder you at all, to be honest, Dave. I think I said in that episode, the Miles Morales in the film is infinitely better than the one Bendis wrote in the comics, so you're probably on safe ground if this is your introduction to Miles Morales. Your discussion of it made it sound interesting enough that I borrowed it from my local library and watched it this afternoon. Thank you. You are very welcome. Wish I got a kickback. I enjoyed it thoroughly, particularly the relationship between Miles and his dad, Jefferson Davis. There's an odd choice for black man's name. I wonder if there's an explanation in the source material for that. And I found myself fascinated with Spider-Man Noir, so maybe I'll have to seek him out in the comics. I always enjoy learning new things, and this podcast is an Aladdin's cave of new things for me to learn. So I thank you very much for that. You're very welcome. Live long and prosper, Dave McElveny. Well, thank you, Dave, and Dave, for emailing in. It was a delight to have a Dave-centric email section. As ever, if you want to be like Dave and Dave, you can email me, even if you're not called Dave. I mean, if you could change your name to Dave if you wanted to. Daniel Dave Doherty? I don't know. You can email me on heykidscomics@virginmedia.com. I may start that thing where you can buy me a coffee if you want to. I like that idea more than Patreon. Patreon gets to be a drag. I'll be brutally honest. You kind of feel that you've got to give people something for the money. And so it stops being fun. And then you've got to do the Patreon exclusives and they really aren't fun. So, you know, whatever. But I think if you do that coffee thing, I think that's more interesting. I don't know whether you can just PayPal me directly at ajleyland@blueyonder.co.uk or do I have to set up some coffee fund thing. But if you want to tip me by buying me a coffee, that would be lovely. But I ain't doing no Patreon thing. This is a one-off doing this for Andrew. I ain't doing requests on a regular basis. I was just flattered that women listen to this. So I thought, okay, I'll do that for Andrew and his girlfriend. You didn't tell me your girlfriend's name, Andrew. You know, she's not your appendage, dude. She's a woman in her own right. Can you tell I've had a drink? Anyway, it's coming up on Christmas. So if you hear this before Christmas, I probably won't get a Christmas episode out this week. This year, it's been hell. Very, very busy time. So I haven't got as many episodes out recently as I would have liked, as you may have noticed. But we've not gone anywhere. We're still here. We're still coming in your earbuds whenever we can. So like I say, email me, drop me a line, get in touch with me however you wish, with whatever you wish to say. And I will see you next time. Hopefully before the end of the year, but you never know, dear. Take care. Everything's going to be fine. There's a vaccine coming. And I'll see you all again real soon. Goodbye.